and we haven't been very good coming from behind. Listen to yourself. Listen. The pitcher grinned sheepishly. At the time, he hadn't been aware of his negative thinking. Now he was hearing himself, in his own words, laying out a scenario for defeat. And he hadn't thrown his first pitch. Is it any wonder he performed poorly? Then I asked what he could have been thinking. The pitcher studied his image on the screen. I've got good control of my fastball. One positive thought led to another. Even if I walk him, I can keep the ball down and get the next guy to hit into a double play. Don't worry about the batter. One pitch at a time. Just focus. Relax. Hit the mitt. We all have conversations going on inside our heads. I call it self-talk. Every athlete hears two competing voices. One is a negative critic. The other is a positive coach. Which voice we listen to is a matter of choice. Golfer Arnold Palmer kept this saying in his locker. If you think you are beaten, you are. If you think that you dare not, you don't. If you'd like to win, but you think you can't, it's almost certain you won't. If you think you'll lose, you've lost. For out in the world, you'll find success begins with a fellow's will. It's all in the state of mind. Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or faster man. But sooner or later, the man who wins is the man who thinks he can. Like our beliefs and attitudes, our thinking can be a powerful ally. How we think affects how we feel, and how we feel affects how we perform. My job is to help athletes think clearly and use their minds effectively by teaching them to turn their negative critic into a positive coach. One day, I was at Yale Field in Connecticut, visiting the Mariners' AA club, the New Haven Ravens. One of the young center fielders was struggling in the batting cage. "Mac, I'm never going to get this," he said between cuts. He shook his head. "I don't have a clue." His negative critic was hard at work, shouting into his ear with a bullhorn. "Let me ask you something," I said. "If Ken Griffey Jr. thought like that, how good a batter do you think he would be?" The question stopped the kid. He knew that if Griffey thought the way the minor leaguer did, the Mariners' slugger wouldn't perform well either. The kid's thinking was hurting him more than his swing. He needed to change his thinking, or at least give his mind a rest. Ted Williams offered some sage advice. If you don't think too good, then don't think too much. Just as we have irrational and unrealistic beliefs, we all are guilty of distorted and dysfunctional thinking. Atlanta Braves pitcher Tom Glavine said, "I went through the don't do this syndrome at certain times in my career when facing certain batters. I told myself not to hang a curveball. Sure enough, I did. Now I focus on do this. It's a significant difference." I worked with a professional golfer who listened to his negative critic. Like the pitcher, he watched himself on video. What was he thinking on this shot? How about the next? After listening to his negative narrative, I asked who would be a positive coach for him. He said Ken Venturi. As we returned to the video, I asked what Venturi would tell him. "He would say, I'm good enough to do this. I can hit this shot. Just trust my swing." Tiger Woods has a positive coach with him at all times. During the last round of the 1999 PGA Championship, he faced an 8-foot par putt on the 17th hole. He had to make it to keep the lead. Sergio Garcia was one shot back. As Tiger stood over the ball, he said he heard a familiar voice. It was the soft voice of the man who taught him to play golf. That man wasn't in the gallery. He was several miles away, in a hotel room, watching the tournament on TV. "Trust your stroke," the voice whispered. "Trust your stroke." Tiger heard and trusted. The putt fell. At the victory party that night, Earl Woods's son said, "I heard you, Pop." Which voice do you hear? Which is louder? the negative critic, or the positive coach. You can choose to listen to the voice that offers and reinforces positive thought. It has been said that thoughts become words. Words become actions. Actions become habits. Habits become character. Character becomes your destiny. Mental training teaches you to think clearly and use your mind effectively. Just the way you learn not to swing at bad pitches, you must learn not to chase bad thoughts. Learn to turn your negative critic into a positive coach. Servant or master? Learn to control your emotions, or they will control you. Edgar Martinez. A ball player who loses his head and can't keep his cool is worse than no player at all. Lou Gehrig. The Philadelphia Phillies had just blown a game against the Houston Astros, surrendering the winning run in the bottom of the ninth. When the manager stormed into the losing team's clubhouse and found his players enjoying a post-game buffet, his eyes widened. He felt his blood pressure rise. Suddenly, with a wide sweep of his arm, the skipper cleared the table, sending drumsticks, potato salad, and a tray of assorted fruit flying. "Boy," a rookie whispered, as the room, splattered with barbecue sauce, fell deathly silent. "The food sure goes fast around here." Sports arouses emotions and passions like no other endeavor. We see that fervor in highly competitive athletes like Jimmy Connors, who said, "I thrive on emotions. The emotional energy allows me to raise my level of play." We also see it in those who follow sports as spectators. The achievements of one athlete can energize and inspire an entire nation. Sayree Park left her homeland as a virtual unknown. When the young golfer returned to Seoul after winning 4 LPGA tournaments during her rookie year, thousands greeted her at the airport. The Korean people took her into their hearts. Park had become a national symbol of triumph over adversity. Our attitudes, belief systems, and thoughts create our reality. They also create our emotions. Joy is one, pride another. Two other basic emotions are anger and fear. Anyone who has participated in athletics probably has experienced all four. In Getting Over Yourself, we mentioned an evolutionary primitive mechanism called the fight or flight response. When we feel threatened or stressed, our heart beats faster, our breathing quickens, and our hands may sweat. It's like gulping an adrenaline cocktail. We respond with the urge to flee or fight back. The latter often leads to anger. Customato, who trained Mike Tyson, said emotions, particularly anger, are like fire. They can cook your food and keep you warm, or they can burn your house down. Many great athletes use anger in a positive way. Anger motivates them. Anger steals their resolve. It is much better to become angry than to become afraid. Last season, Randy Johnson was at the plate facing Sterling Hitchcock, who had just given up back-to-back home runs. The San Diego pitcher struck Johnson on the left elbow with a pitch. Johnson flashed with anger. He could have initiated a fight and risked ejection, but he didn't. Channeling his anger, the Arizona pitcher, known as the Big Unit, went back to the mound, struck out 11 batters, pitched a complete game, and extended his season record to 7-0. Albert Bell uses his anger to crush baseballs over the fence. Pete Rose warned, "When you mess with my pride, you're going to get into trouble." Michael Jordan is another prideful man. When challenged on the basketball court, he exhibited what golfer Sam Snead called a cool mad. In the playoffs, Jordan was always the smiling assassin. Sports can be frustrating. It's easy to respond out of anger, without thought or control. When he was 12 years old, Bjorn Borg couldn't control his temper. I was throwing my racket all over the place, hitting balls over the fence. Everything, the former tennis great recalled. My parents were ashamed and finally refused to come to a single match. Arthur Ashe threw his racket for the first time when he was 10. Ronald Charity, the man who introduced the boy to tennis, took him to Dr. Robert W. Johnson, a black physician and tennis enthusiast in Lynchburg, Virginia. The training sessions were long and demanding. In the segregated South during the 1950s, Dr. Johnson knew that tournament directors would kick black kids out of their tournaments if they could find any reason. The Arthur Ashe I played against as a teenager was under control, seemingly imperturbable. As a youngster, Bobby Jones was beating everyone at the local golf club, but he had a hot temper. He earned the nickname Club Thrower. Jones became friends with an elderly man everyone knew as Grandpa Bart, who worked part-time at the pro shop. At age 14, Jones played in the National Amateur, but came home a loser. "Bobby, you're good enough to win that tournament," Grandpa Bart told him, "but you'll never win until you control that temper of yours." Jones knew the old man was right, but it was 7 years later before he won a tournament. Bobby was 14 years old when he mastered the game of golf, Grandpa Bart said, but he was 21 before he mastered himself. When you let anger get the best of you, it usually brings out the worst in you. Basketball player Latrell Sprewell choked his coach. Roberto Alomar spit at an umpire and became one of the most reviled players in baseball. After Mike Tyson bit Evander Holyfield's ear, he was ordered to undergo a psychological examination. Uncontrolled anger has led to riots and even death in the sports arena. A few years ago, I was asked to write a sports psychology manual for the Seattle Mariners. I interviewed some of the team's top players. One of them was Edgar Martinez. His manager, Lou Piniella, loves the guy. "Edgar is so professional," Piniella said, "nothing fazes him. He's as cool as a cucumber at the plate." During my interview, I asked Martinez what was the biggest jump for him, personally, going from the minor leagues to the majors. His answer surprised me. "I worked a lot on my emotions," Martinez said. "I don't have a real bad temper, but I can remember some things I've done in the past, like hit the wall or hit the helmet box. But I learned from experienced players that that's not the way you do it. Don't let your teammates or the other team know that you're down or struggling. It's going to hurt your teammates because they're not going to trust you. If you're going to get upset, don't do it on the field. Go into the bathroom or someplace where you are alone and just let it go. I think that's the best advice I've been given." Borg soon learned. A player who cannot control his temper on the court will never become a great player. Jack Nicklaus asks a good question. "How many shots would you have saved if you never lost your temper, never got down on yourself, always developed a strategy before you hit, and always played within your capabilities?" The best athletes are masters of their emotions and not servants to them. A batter who is controlled by anger and frustration isn't likely to be successful in his next time at the plate. He presses. He feels like he's trying to hit a 3-run home run with no one on base. Pitcher Jim Palmer said whenever he became angry, he sat down and tried to analyze what he did wrong and correct it the next time. The legendary Satchel Paige, who pitched in a major league game at the age of 59, said, "If your stomach disputes you, lie down and pacify it with cooling thoughts." Simple words, wise advice. Buy the solution, not the emotion. When you let anger get the best of you, it brings out the worst in you. The key question is, who is in control, you or your emotions? Remember, before you can control your performance, you need to be in control of yourself. fear lives in the future. Of all the hazards, fear is the worst. Sam Snead. The absolute worst thing a receiver can do is worry about not catching the ball or about getting hit. Jerry Rice. The Phoenix Fire Department is as selective in employment as a professional sports team. Those who want to become firefighters must have the right stuff. Trainees are required to perform many demanding tasks, including climbing the tall ladder in full gear used in rescues. For the past 20 years, I have been training booters, firefighting recruits, on the mental aspects of performance. I often give a classroom demonstration. It is a test you can take yourself. If I asked you to stand on the seat of a chair or on a tabletop, would you have a problem doing that? Probably not. But what if that chair or table were 20 stories in the air and I asked you to perform the same task? What thoughts would you have? How would you feel? Could you do it? The task is the same. So what is the difference? For many, it's a four-letter word. Fear. Fear is a mental response to a perceived danger or threat. As former golfing great Sam Snead said, fear is the worst hazard because it creates tension, doubts, or even panic. While on an African safari, Snead once shot a charging wild elephant that was 30 yards in front of him. It didn't hit the ground until it was right at my feet, Snead recalled. I wasn't a bit scared, but a 4-foot putt scares me to death. Fear releases chemical hormones that can inhibit performance and shut you down. When you are afraid in sports, you play small. Because you're focusing on the negative, you worry about making mistakes. I recently played my college roommate in golf. Chris was captain of our college basketball team while I captained the tennis team. We have been competing against each other for almost 30 years with bragging rights on the line. I'm a much better golfer than Chris. I should beat him. But when he comes to Arizona and we play on my home course, where I should hold a big advantage, I don't perform well. Instead of playing my game, I play it safe. I play not to lose. I play small. I play scared. Fearful of running the ball past the hole and three-putting and losing a stroke to my opponent's handicap, I choke up and leave the first putt short and three-putt anyway. What I've had to learn, what I'm still working at, is not to let fear control me. Stop worrying about making a mistake. Fear is something we learn as kids. A big coach might yell, "You screwed up again," or "How can you be so stupid?" Youngsters internalize those critical messages. From an early age, they would then develop a fear of failure, a fear of doing the wrong thing. I have great admiration for the Special Olympics program. Its motto is, "Let me win, but if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt." Coaches and volunteers provide what every athlete needs, encouragement and support. Most Special Olympians, children and adults who are mentally challenged, have no fear of failure when they run a 50-meter race, do the long jump, or throw a shot put. Fear lives in the future. These athletes live in the present, the here and now. Their participation is fun and rewarding. Fear reminds me of the wizard in the magical land of Oz. It is an unseen presence, a booming voice behind a curtain. Fear is as big and powerful as we imagine it to be. Some athletes resist fear, or some try to deny fear. Others attempt to conquer it. I suggest one shouldn't do any of those things. Fear is a natural part of performance. Former Olympian Bruce Jenner said, "Fear is part of the process. If you weren't scared, you'd be in trouble." When you resist fear, you're only keeping it alive. It's like trying to hold a beach ball underwater. The more you fight it, the more pressure you're building up. Athletes should accept fear and recognize it as the body's way of telling them to become energized. Don't let fear hunt you. Instead, hunt your own fears. Pull the curtain away. Unmask your fears and face them down. Examine them. Many times when fear starts to hit me, my best chance of overcoming it lies in facing it squarely and examining it rationally, Jack Nicholas said. Here is what I say to myself. Okay, what are you frightened of? You've obviously played well overall. You're always telling yourself you get your biggest kicks out of the challenges of golf. Well, go ahead and enjoy yourself. Play each shot one at a time and meet the challenge. I once lived alongside the Orange Tree Golf Course in Scottsdale, Arizona. My house was about 240 yards from the tee box of the 17th hole. It amazed me how often I would find two golf balls in my backyard, one within a foot of the other, both bearing the same company logo. Apparently, one weekend golfer feared slicing his drive out of bounds. His negative thinking helped create the result he feared most. When he teed up the second ball, he worried about making the same mistake, and usually did. Al Henderson, a former coach of the U.S. Olympic archery team, said, "Fretting about the shot you just made will get you another just like it." Jerry Rice, the all-pro wide receiver, learned how worrying can undermine performance. "I've matured," he said. "When I drop passes, I don't get down on myself the way I did when I was a rookie. On the short drops, I used to tense up. I tried to do too much. I started to think too much, instead of just doing what I had done in practice 1,000 times. Catch the ball. I worried about dropping the ball." How does fear limit your life, your performance? What thoughts accompany your fears? What physical sensations do you experience? Many great athletes who use anger as motivation also turn fear into an ally. Listen again to Bruce Jenner. "I was scared to death, but I made fear score points for me. Fear is right behind me. Fear is 6 inches off my back. That's where fear is. I can feel its presence, but it's not going to catch me. I'm going to take fear and use it to my advantage." Remember, fear doesn't keep you safe. Your training does. Don't let fear scare you. Feel the fear and do it anyway. Fear is often false evidence appearing real. Breathe and focus. We all choke. Winners know how to handle choking better than losers. John McEnroe. You have to learn how to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Lupinella. Choker. It's the ugliest label in sports. Society views choking in competition as dishonorable, shameful, and unforgivable. Athletes who choke are seen as cowards, weak-willed. Their moral character is flawed. The Houston Rockets blew a 20-point lead in the fourth quarter at home against the Phoenix Suns in a 1994 NBA playoff loss. The next day's condemning headlines in both Houston newspapers screamed, "Choke City." "Why our town?" one sports writer moaned in print. It was as if he took the team's defeat personally. His face burned with shame. In sports, there is no more damning gesture than a mocking hand to the throat, the choke sign. Yet choking happens every day. It happens at Wimbledon. It happens at the Olympic Games. No one is immune. "We all choke," said golfer Curtis Strange, who won back-to-back U.S. Open championships. "You're not human if you haven't. We get just as nervous as the average guy playing for the club championship." Lee Trevino compares an athlete who caves in to anxiety with a race car suffering mechanical problems. Everybody leaks oil. In 1996, Greg Norman blew a 6-shot lead in the final round of the Masters. His fate inspired comparisons with the late-season collapse of the 64 Phillies and the Hindenburg disaster. Last spring, Blaine McAllister only had to par the last hole in New Orleans to win his first PGA tournament in 7 years. He made bogey. Then he missed a 4-foot putt on the first playoff hole that would have clinched the victory. McAllister lost on the next hole to Carlos Franco. It had been a long time and the old nerves were going a little bit, McAllister said, when asked to explain his unraveling. I felt like I bled all over the place out there. I'll be the first to admit I choked it and missed it on the 73rd hole. It cost me, and I'll hear about it a while. McAllister wasn't the only one. A week earlier, Craig Stadler had a chance to win for the first time since 1996. His putter failed him on 3 playoff holes. He finished second to Robert Allenby at the Houston Open. Choking is a normal human reaction, a physiological response to a perceived psychological threat. To demonstrate what choking is, I ask athletes to stand and do the breathless exercise. You can do it too. First, I tell the group, this is a contest. I am going to watch each of them and judge everyone's performance carefully. Then I begin barking verbal commands. Look left. Look right. Look left. Look right. Look left. Look right. Look right. Some automatically dart their eyes to the left, anticipating that command. As they continue the task, their anxiety increases. Their breathing pattern changes. Without realizing it, many hold their breath. Oxygen is energy. It's juice. Oxygen helps relax muscles and clear the mind. When you hold your breath, you are creating pressure and a nervous feeling. Athletes who choke start to become nervous about being nervous, anxious about being anxious. One psychologist says anxiety is excitement without the breath. The pattern of your breathing affects the pattern of your performance. When you are under stress, deep breathing helps bring your mind and body back into the present. Over the years, I have handed out thousands of little stickers to athletes that read, "Breathe and focus." A baseball player will place the bright orange circle on the shoulder of his uniform or underneath the bill of his cap or on the barrel of his bat. A hockey player might affix it to his stick. Firefighters I have worked with place the stickers on their self-contained breathing apparatus. The stickers serve as a reminder. Whenever they feel themselves growing anxious, breathe in energy. Breathe out negativity. Breathe in relaxation. Breathe out stress. 1 year at spring training, the Mariners tested a new pitcher they had acquired in a trade. The club wanted to see if he could go 5 innings. In the 5th, he began to fade. He gave up a hit, then another, then another. Seated in the dugout, Lou Piniella turned to me and shook his head. "Mac," Piniella said, "this guy doesn't know how to be comfortable with being uncomfortable." Piniella sent his pitching coach to the mound. When he returned, the coach told Lou, "His eyes are in the back of his head." Translation: the guy isn't there anymore. Piniella took the pitcher out. What did he mean by learning how to become comfortable with being uncomfortable? Have you ever stepped into a cold shower or icy lake or swimming pool? The cold takes your breath away. Your first impulse is to get out. But if you breathe and stay focused, you gradually become accustomed to the water temperature. The experience is akin to performing under pressure. By breathing and focusing, you can systematically desensitize yourself. In addition to changing their breathing patterns, athletes under stress become internally self-conscious instead of externally task-conscious. Their focus turns inward. I suggest athletes who become anxious focus externally. When one of my best friends, Jim Colburn, pitched for the Brewers, he refocused on the task by looking at the flagpole in Milwaukee's County Stadium. Judge Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the following about bird hunting but the advice applies to any athlete in competition. If you want to hit a bird on the wing, you must have all your will in a focus. You must not be thinking about yourself. And equally, you must not be thinking about your neighbor. You must be living in your eye on that bird. Choking is nothing more than paying attention to your physiology when you should be focusing on your opponent and the task. At times we all get nervous and anxious. Learn to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Use your breathing to focus your energy. Let your breath center your mind and body in the present. Be here now. Each point I play is in the now moment. The last point means nothing. The next point means nothing. Billie Jean King. You must be present to win. Alex Rodriguez. Alex Rodriguez enjoyed a magical season in 1996. The young shortstop for the Mariners led the American League in batting average, runs, total bases, grand slams, and doubles, and he was runner-up most valuable player, finishing second to Juan Gonzalez of Texas in the closest vote in more than 35 years. 5 months later, Alex reported to spring training, eager to start anew. Rodriguez is a likable fellow, and his disposition is as sunny as the Arizona sky. I greeted him with a hug. Then I asked about his goals for the coming year. Most athletes are numbers-oriented. A ball player doesn't have to look up his slugging percentage or earned run average. His stats are like important phone numbers. He knows them by heart. So I expected this 21-year-old to say he wanted to drive in more runs or raise his batting average, which would take some doing. Alex hit .358 the previous year. Instead, his answer floored me and made me smile. "Bat Mac," Rodriguez said, addressing me by my baseball nickname. "My only goal is to learn how to play one entire game in the present." To play an entire game in the present moment is the ultimate in mental discipline. Many managers and coaches preach the value of playing the game one pitch at a time, or one play at a time. One reason Alex became a star at a young age is because he recognizes the importance of the mental game and understands what it is to play in the present. But the skill isn't quickly or easily learned. The late Bobby Jones, one of the greatest golfers in history, said, "It's nothing new or original to say that golf is played one stroke at a time. But it took me years to realize it." Successful athletes who speak of playing in the zone are describing what it feels like to perform in the present, mind and body attuned, working together. When you are playing your game right on time, in the present, you perform at your best. Why? Because in the present, there is no pressure. Pressure is created by anxieties about the future and remembered failures from the past. If a baseball player comes to the plate thinking about his last strikeout or says to himself, "If I don't start hitting, I'll be on the bench soon," is he playing in the present? Obviously, the answer is no. During an off-season, I worked with one of the premier base dealers in the game. "What happens," I asked, "if while on base he begins thinking about the last time he was thrown out?" To make a point, I jumped on his back. I felt like an oversized papoose, but the player got the message. Is it easier to steal a base with a monkey on your back? Thinking about the past instead of the present can only slow you down. In a Peanuts comic strip, Lucy is apologizing to Charlie Brown. "Sorry I missed that easy fly ball, manager." In the second frame, Lucy says, "I thought I had it, but suddenly I remembered all the others I've missed." In the last panel, she diagnoses her problem. "The past got in my eyes." I would tell Lucy what I tell professional athletes. As you learned earlier, worrying about a mistake will usually get you another one just like it. One key to learning how to play the game at your best is recognizing when your head is not in the present. I am reminded of the television public service message that asks parents, It's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your kids are? Ask yourself this. It's game time. Do you know where your mind is? My definition of awareness is paying attention on purpose without analysis or judgment. Simply put, it is moment-to-moment observation, being absorbed in the task. Try this. Become aware of your breathing. Count the breaths you take. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Repeat the exercise. Do it again. Keep counting. Again. It seems like a simple task, but eventually your mind begins to wander. If your mind isn't on your breathing, what is it on? I recently had a conversation with a National Hockey League player. He described a game in which he found himself repeatedly glancing at the clock. As the seconds ticked away on his shift, all he could think about was the fact he hadn't scored and time was running out. If he had one eye on the clock, I told him, then he had only one eye on the puck. To be present to win, both eyes have to be on the target, the puck, the ball, the basket, or the job at hand. Let the clock take care of itself. How do you place your mind in the here and now? When I worked with the Chicago Cubs, we used a technique called the mental locker. When a player arrived at the clubhouse at Wrigley Field or the visiting ballpark, he opened his mental locker. With each article of clothing he removed, his jacket, his shirt, his belt, one sock, then the other, he let go of a problem or a personal concern. By the time he had changed from civilian clothes into his uniform, he had shed all his distractions and personal concerns and was focusing on the present. He was in the right time zone and the ideal state of mind to experience success on the field. Joe Paterno is one of college football's most admired and successful coaches. Every football player at Penn State is familiar with the blue line that divides the campus and the school's football complex. Papa Joe tells each student-athlete that before he crosses that imaginary blue line, on the way to practice, or when he leaves his locker for a game, he expects him to dump all his worries and concerns. Once he steps across the line, he cannot be thinking about what grade he made on yesterday's math test, or daydreaming about tomorrow night's date. The moment he crosses the threshold, his mind should be focused on Penn State football and nothing else. If it isn't, he is shortchanging himself as an athlete. He is also hurting the team. He is not fully present to win. Learn from the past. Prepare for the future. Perform in the present. Hurry slowly. Be quick, but never hurry. John Wooden. Never hurry when it counts. Joanne Carner. You can feel the excitement on the first morning of the Griffey International Baseball Camp. More than 200 kids from Alabama to Australia gather at the Disney World Sports Complex in Orlando, which is the spring training home of the Atlanta Braves, for 5 days of baseball instruction and fun. Lined up along the third base line, the youngsters are wearing their camp T-shirts and big smiles that say they can't wait to get started. As director of sports psychology for Griffey International, I welcome the kids to the camp and then conduct a contest. We're going to find out who the fastest kids in camp are, I tell them. Now, when I count to three, you have to wait for the count. When I count to three, I want everybody, all of you, to run to the nearest fence. Standing at shortstop, I glance at the center field fence behind me. From the smallest to the largest, the campers toe the third base chalk line in delicious anticipation, motors revving. Okay. You ready? I pause for dramatic effect. 1, 2, 3, go! In a burst of pent-up energy, away they go, dashing straight ahead, legs churning, arms pumping, the wind snatching baseball caps off their heads. After reaching the center field fence, the sprinters return, panting and exhausted. Then a comprehending look comes over their faces as they spot about a dozen campers, smiling like the cat that ate the canary, and leaning nonchalantly against the fence behind the third base line. They aren't winded, and they aren't tired. Those few had ignored my nonverbal cue and simply turned around and, as instructed, gone to the nearest fence. The others feel a little like former NFL defensive great Jim Marshall after he picked up a fumble and ran 62 yards into the end zone, the wrong end zone, and scored a safety for the other team. In sports, what happens when we become anxious and emotionally charged? Most people start rushing. They speed up and get ahead of themselves. A second baseman trying to turn a double play will throw the ball before he has control of it. A wide receiver will turn upfield before he makes the catch. A pitcher walks a batter and then surrenders a home run at a critical point in the game. Suddenly, he and his team are in a hole. His breathing quickens. His heart begins trip-hammering into his chest. Angry with himself, his ego bruised, the pitcher is no longer thinking clearly. His mind starts to race. He takes himself out of his normal rhythm, without even knowing it. When an athlete is in the zone, everything around him seems to slow down. He feels as if he is performing at an almost leisurely pace. Under stress, the pitcher's world is speeded up, like an old silent movie. He feels a rising sense of urgency. He becomes as panicky as the frenetic white rabbit in Alice in Wonderland. "I'm so late, so very, very late." In a hurry, his mind no longer in the present, he reverts to what coaches call primitive pitching. Instead of pitching with a purpose, he speeds up. His command changes from "ready, aim, fire" to "ready, fire, aim." The pitcher is like a Peruvian tennis player I watched competing in the Davis Cup. The Peruvian was quicker and more talented than his Bahamian opponent, and he was having his way in the match until he got a bad line call, and then another one. He became visibly angry. After that, all his movements appeared hurried. Still simmering, he sailed through the next game so fast, I doubt he even knew what he was doing. Unable to regain his composure and slow his tempo, he lost the next two sets and the match. Recall what Jack Nicklaus said in the section entitled "The Pressure Principle." When an athlete tenses up, he often wants to get the test over and done with as fast as possible. The more he hurries, the worse he will probably perform. And the worse he performs, the more he hurries, creating a self-defeating cycle. Lee Trevino didn't enjoy playing at the Masters. He said the course didn't fit his game. He complained about the speed of the greens, jokingly suggesting that before each round, tournament officials coated them with STP, a motor oil additive. Trevino plays fast, but he may have set a speed record for touring Augusta National's 18 holes. Frustrated and irritated by his poor play, Trevino barely settled into his stance before whacking his second shot toward the green on the 18th hole. Alluding to the Civil War and the Union general who burned Atlanta, Trevino hurried toward the white, plantation-style clubhouse, muttering, "Sherman should have finished the job." The Arizona Cardinals were in San Francisco to play the 49ers. While seated on the team bus for the ride to Candlestick Park, I noticed a sign above the driver's head. The sign was titled, "The First Rule of Holes," and it read, "When you find yourself in a hole, the first rule is to stop digging." All athletes become frustrated. At some point, they all dig themselves into a hole. The best advice I can give is to remember the first rule of holes. If you find yourself in a hole, imagine a red traffic sign that says, "Stop." Sometimes the best form of action is inaction. What's the old saying? Don't just do something, stand there. What many young athletes need to learn is that sometimes going faster can make them slower. It's one of the paradoxes of sports. Whenever Seattle pitcher Jamie Moyer finds himself in a hole, when he feels his anxiety rise and he starts to get the goddess, thinking, I gotta do this, I gotta do that, he knows it's time for him to put the shovel down. Moyer steps off the mound and onto the infield grass. He rubs up the ball, turning it over in his hands. He shakes the tension from his neck. He takes a break and a breath. The most successful athletes do what Moyer does and what managers do. They call a timeout and gather themselves. Earlier, we talked about creating a mind gym. Go back to your mind gym and recreate a situation in which you fell into a competitive hole and became overanxious and panicky. Recall how you responded. Then, rewrite the script. Visualize taking a timeout. See yourself refocusing and returning to the present. Remember, the first step toward regaining composure and tempo is right under your nose, just a deep breath away. The more you hurry, the later you get. When you find yourself rushing, you are no longer in the present. Pace instead of race. Try easier. The less tension and effort, the faster and more powerful you will be. Bruce Lee. The way to run faster is with 4/5 effort. Just take it nice and easy. Bud Winters. Just as Tiger Woods does now, Sam Snead dominated professional golf in his prime because he outdistanced the rest of the field. Snead didn't appear to drive the ball with muscle. On the contrary, the man who years after retirement age remained so loose-limbed he could bend over and place his palms flat against the ground was poetry in motion. Snead played golf to waltz time. His tempo was as smooth as the tone in his voice when he addressed his friend on the tee. I believe in giving the ball some sweet talk, Snead once said. This isn't going to hurt a bit, I whispered under my breath. Sambo was just going to give you a little ride. When Ken Griffey Jr. steps to the plate, he doesn't grind his bat handle into sawdust. I'm not that strong, Griffey said. I probably only bench press about 200 pounds. The source of his power isn't brute strength, but rather leverage, flexibility, and range of motion. I don't consider myself a home run hitter, but when I'm seeing the ball and hitting it hard, it will go out of the park. Sports glorify strength. Coaches demand that athletes give 110%, ignoring the fact that it's a mathematical impossibility. Truth is, muscles and strength aren't everything. Overtrying leads to underperforming. Trying harder, which athletes do when they tense up under pressure, oftentimes is counterproductive. Bud Winters, one of America's most successful track and field coaches, told his athletes, just take it nice and easy. Jay Novacek, the tight end on the Dallas Cowboys' early 90s Super Bowl teams, ran track in college. We were working out together one day when Jay told me about an experiment his coach performed. Novacek and his teammates were instructed to run 800 meters as fast as they could. Later, the coach had them run the same distance, only at 90% of top speed. What surprised me and all of us, Novacek said, was that our times were better when we ran at 90% than when we went all out. What's the explanation? Voluntary muscles are organized in opposing pairs. Running and many other sports are performed most effectively when some muscles are contracting while others are relaxing. Running at top speed, athletes use all of their muscles, the agonists and the antagonists. They are accelerating and braking at the same time. The muscles are at odds. This prevents them from running as fast as they can. Giving 90% effort, runners expend a lot of muscular energy, but they relax the antagonist muscles that hinder maximum performance. The same is true in pitching. trying to throw a ball as hard as he can, a pitcher uses all of the muscles in his arm. But to achieve accuracy and speed, flexor muscles, or biceps, need to relax, while extensor muscles, or triceps, do most of the work. Nolan Ryan's major league career spanned the administrations of 6 U.S. presidents. Baseball's strikeout king threw very hard, but he didn't overthrow, which is one reason for his longevity. The tendency of a fastball pitcher is to muscle up and do what he needs to do, Ryan said. He winds up lunging and losing his rhythm, trying to muscle the ball in there. Everybody has limits. You just have to learn what your own limits are and deal with them accordingly. My tennis partner, Brad Harper, continually reminds me to relax on my serve. Mac, spaghetti arm. Under pressure, we tend to muscle up. When my arm is loose, I'm better able to snap my wrist and generate more power. Mark Connor, the Toronto Blue Jays pitching coach, demonstrates the physiology by having his pitchers swing a long-handled switch, first with the large muscles in their arm, and then using just a quick wrist flick. Pitchers are taught to grip a baseball as if it were an egg, but in the heat of competition, some squeeze it as if they are choking a chicken. The most common physical cause of error in golf, and perhaps all of sports, is over-tightness. Over-tightening muscles to produce power actually creates a loss of power and accuracy. Instead of relaxing and releasing, the golfer starts tensing, which hurts coordination. Bobby Jones said that an anxious player's impulse is to steer the ball, which accounts for most bad shots. In the Know Your Numbers section, we compared tension with guitar strings. If the strings are too loose, the music is flat. If they are too tight, the strings will snap. You should always be able to feel the grip of the bat, the club, or the racket. If you can't, your grip is too tight. I wait and wait and let the ball get right on top of me and just swing with a loose grip, says Tony Gwynn, one of baseball's best hitters. If you can't feel your swing, you're swinging too fast or too hard. Willie McGee once complained to his hitting coach that he couldn't relax. Willie, Bernardo Leonard told the player, an anxious mind cannot exist in a relaxed body. When one is anxious, so is the other. When one is at rest, so is the other. In the same way you create stress and tension, you also can create relaxation. The goal of relaxation training is to teach you how to recognize the early warning signs of tension and to counter or replace them with the sensations of relaxation. Interestingly, one way to relax tense muscles is first to tighten them more. If your shoulders feel like coiled springs, draw them up and squeeze those muscles. Hold the pose for 5 to 10 seconds. Feel the stress and study the sensation. Then, release and relax the muscles completely. If you can relax your body, you can relax your mind. Quiet mind, quiet body. Relaxation happens when you stop creating tension. Overtrying leads to underperforming. Simply observe. You can observe a lot just by watching. Yogi Berra. It's not between me and the pitcher. It's between me and the ball. Matt Williams. Years ago, while working as a photojournalist in New York, I read a book called Enter Tennis. In one chapter, author Tim Galway shares a simple teaching technique that is rooted in one of the most important principles in sports psychology. Galway describes giving a lesson to a woman who had never played tennis. As expected, she felt nervous and self-conscious. Instead of filling her head with a mental list of commands to remember each time she swung, racket back, bend your